Hello, outsiders. This week we had some issues with Michael's audio. He had to use Zoom again because sometimes life happens. So his audio is going to be a little bit choppy, but next week we'll be right as rain, back to the quality standards that we hold ourselves to. Until then, enjoy this episode with the Dieter Biedekar.
So, that's pretty good.
Welcome to another episode of Outside the Pages. We have a very special guest today as we talk about Matt Fraction, in my opinion, his crowning opus. I am always in Poet Air, and I'm joined, as always, by Chaz Simons and Synthetic. And today we have a very special guest, Aditya Biedekar, to discuss November. How are you doing?
Hey, folks. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
Oh, yeah.
September here, so...
Right? We're a little early to be talking about November, but earlier the better, I say.
Well, the book ran off its schedule quite thoroughly, so I don't think that should be a problem.
I got to think about November and read about November so many months from like 2019 to 2021. I think that's how long the book took, right? Or is it 2019?
Yeah, so. It was supposed to take November to November.
Yeah.
But then the pandemic happened.
Happened and kind of messed everything up.
Yeah.
This is a great, I would call like, Chaz always describes it as like a Paul Thomas Anderson book by way of Matt Fraction, but it's a, I see it. You want to say something?
But I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah.
Thomas Anderson bit.
For me, it's like Magnolia in scale and scope about the tiny coincidences and the overlapping nature of lives and how they come in and out of each other, but bonded in this sense by a gun in a puddle and like how much chaos and confusion that throws three women's lives into. And then the powerful forces at work outside and in that push them forward on this journey and inward to themselves. So it, like reading that first volume gave me that flash of like, I'm meeting all of these people in Magnolia. And at times I'm like, yeah, that's a good story. But when is it going to like kind of overlap and cross-sect here? But then you realize like, oh, it's not that straight line. It's like a circle that curves back and around and inward to these people. So yeah, this is,
right.
Yeah, for me, it's like Criminal by way of Paul Thomas Anderson.
That's a great
That's quite interesting. Like I think I always looked at it almost like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Because essentially it's the story of the people who are on the periphery of the tertiary characters of a massive crime book.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like so the book is happening somewhere, and then the people on the periphery are the policemen who are involved in the, you know, the smuggling of drugs and stuff. And these women are on the periphery of that. And yet they have full lives and like, you know, stuff. So I always looked at it as like almost like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. So I like the Paul Thomas Anderson thing.
I like your sort of description of it a lot as well, because there is the backdrop of it is that this whole city is on fire. There's more than one sense even, but like there is a lot happening that we don't even get to experience other than by just even passing mention or quick.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you have to piece together the story. Like, I mean, I don't think I'm still entirely sure what the main plot is. Like what the main crime drama going on is, but it's something on the scale of like The Wire or something, I guess. I don't know exactly what it is. I know that smuggling through evidence bags is involved in some ways.
It's kind of an interesting thing is how they just launch us in without telling us anything, and then we unravel like a fraction, a Matt Fraction of what it is. you know, because it starts off with this girl D in a diner, and this guy shows up, is like, I know your entire daily routine and who you are and everything. You're good with numbers, so solve this puzzle we're going to put in the newspaper every day and go and speak it into a speaker, and that's it. We'll pay you $500 a week, or I mean a day. And you're like, what the fuck is she doing? Like, she's just like, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And he's like,
who wouldn't? It's $500 a day.
Well, you know, there's a catch. All right,
yeah, that's good money.
I'd do it.
And he's like, and she's like, well, yeah. What happens if, well, I guess this a little later, but she's like, what happens if there's no numbers in the paper that day or I don't get them in? And he's like, the end of the world.
I gotta agree with Aditya about, like, because it was my third time reading it all, but this is the first time I read all of them together. So I like read the first one, then read the first one again when I read the second one, and then when the came out, I would read like the previous volume. So I read three and then four, but this time reading it all together, there it's such a puzzle. It's so many puzzle pieces. Like, it's a puzzle thriller drama that there's so much stuff I noticed this read that I did not catch at all the other two times I read it, where I'm like, oh, this is why that's that. And I got to see like the symbolism more. Like, I love the part where he first goes the evidence locker man who hires D, and they're kind of explaining evidence and why you can't lose evidence and how it's all interconnected like a chain. And then I realized like chain link fence we keep seeing is kind of a metaphor about everyone's connected, even they don't know it, and how it's connected. So I got a lot more into that story. Whereas the first time I read, like, the other pieces of the story, they actually connect like the larger plot going on. Like, this is the first time I realized the police are the ones who set off the bombs to distract everyone from what they were doing at the evidence lab. First time I didn't even notice that. I thought it was just random bombs and they're all
cut right
off the ass of the city. But this time I was like, oh, of course they set this up. And then this time I noticed that when Kowalski, who's one of my favorite, I mean, they're all great characters, but Kowalski to me is like
she's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Of the story, like such a hero, and like what she's willing to risk to make things right, like throw away her literal life just to kind of fix the error of her past. And like, I noticed the first building she's going to is Dee's building, which the first time I was reading it, I didn't realize she was at Dee's building.
Yep.
It's very rewarding each time you read it. And I'll probably notice a lot more next time, like the way it's assembled. And first of all, when I mentioned the artist, Elsa, I mean, you've worked with
Chartier, I think.
So that's what I call her. Yeah, good. Also, Chartier does the art. She's fantastic. She has a great way to looking like a cartoon, but also giving like a noir hard edge to it. Like, it's in the way the colors by Hollingsworth kind of depict Matt Hollingsworth's colors in each character and each scene.
I think this reading, I really noticed how much the colors were doing. Like, there's an entire story being told in the colors that you can trace through all four volumes. And that's like, it's just beautifully organized.
That's the first time I noticed it too. And then I noticed at the end, like the very end, the prologue or the epilogue, as I should say, the epilogue is the first time it's just normal full color, which I didn't.
Yep. I noticed like, that this time as
because
well.
Because they're out of the shock of the event. It's like normal life. Like, they're no longer in this state that they're
like
in.
November is over, essentially.
So. Yeah, November's over. It's normal life again. It is. And then it's lettered by Kurt and Kenny, who does all handcrafting, which to me, it seems like, at least for D, definitely whiteout pen. I don't know if he did use whiteout pen, but when I read D's, it always reminds me of like old whiteout pen. Like, have you ever used whiteout pen? And he was doing her writing.
Yeah.
Each character has distinctive handwriting. D's is kind of sloppy. Emma Rose, who's our other main protagonist, hers is more just like normal, like English writing. And then Kowalski is the cursive, and it kind of gives each a distinct.
Yeah, apparently the cursive is based on Mother Teresa's handwriting.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. That's crazy.
I wrote an article on the lettering of November for Panel X Panel, Panel by Panel. And like, I was listening to like interviews with Matt Fraction, and he mentioned this at some point of time.
Oh, which is holy
like,
smokes.
That's like above and beyond, I would say.
Yeah. It does. Yeah, it does look like that. I just Googled. Holy moly. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that I knew that you would love the lettering and have a lot to say about it.
Oh, absolutely.
And I realized why Michael loves this story so much. As a big Lost fan, he loves people speaking numbers into speakers with no idea what it does on a set schedule, and it's the end of the world if they don't.
Yeah. But also, jumping ahead a little, it's also very interesting how the book is formatted. The like every page is 12 panels and every chapter has a set number of pages. And like each of them, like, you know, and the first and last page of every chapter has those blank panels, which run like every three panels. And then I think the rhythm starts to break around volume 3, but it's still like overall, you've still got like a, I mean, I didn't do the whole Watchmen thing of actually like counting panels on everything. I didn't have the time, but I would be very interested to see how the, like, okay, which chapter is how many pages in which volume, and you know, how they kind of spread out, because Fraction is a guy who like really plans this stuff. And I would be very interested in seeing like the distribution of numbers and like how that would work.
Oh man, yeah. So there might even be a secret code within this. Now that you're saying
that,
I
mean that would be excessive. Yeah. Like that would almost be something like not even Moore did that. And actually, no, Moore tried to do that in Big Numbers, and like spectacularly, like you know what happened with Big Numbers. So.
Yeah,
so, that's not such a good idea.
Yeah, no, it's a little difficult to pull up.
Absolutely, yeah.
I can dig that though.
Yeah,
I believe Moore was talking in an interview how Neil Gaiman once came down and saw Moore's plotting chart for Big Numbers, and like the look of horror on his face was like incredibly memorable. So yeah, I would love to see Matt Fraction's flowchart for November.
That would be awesome. See his flowchart. I'd also to see if he does like one of those mood boards too, like when he's writing a story, to see kind of like what he was thinking of or reading and listening when he got this. Maybe PTA would be up there. PTA, cool. Criminal.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of different, I would say, female driven stories. Cause for a male writer, this is such a compelling piece of like woman in trouble and being strong for different reasons. Like Dee, who is the first character introduced to it, she went through a lot of trauma in her past, which has made her a cripple, and she's an addict. She's addicted to heroin, and you know, this gives her a lot of money. She doesn't really have anyone to vent to in her personal life, so she's basically a dancer, is the main source of her being able to vent or have any human connection. Emma Rose, who is just like constantly needs to be free and running. I love the story with her backstory with the kite. She had to keep flying, so like every time she's even tried to be put captive, which is how we meet her, she finds a gun in the puddle. The first thing we've seen her is captive by these dirty cops. And then her backstory major reveals that she does not want to be held. Like her main passion in life and motivation is to go as far as possible and be free. And then we have Kowalski, who is the police operator. I don't know that, by the way, dispatcher, the police dispatcher. And her, she, to me, like I said, is the heart of the story. We first meet her, we think she's just a dispatcher. And that's kind of how the story works. Cause she says like, well, I'm not really a cop. This is the closest thing to being a cop. And then later volumes, we find out she was a cop. And the bad guys we have in the story, she once was involved with. And it's kind of like her redemption story. She has a marriage that's kind of failing because she's a recovered alcoholic. And then the city's on fire and she just puts her wife because she wants to go out because she knows it's the cops because she got the from Emma. Yep. And then Emma disappears and she kind of puts the pieces together that her ex-partner out there who's a car 216 and is kind of perpetrating this violence to cover up their crimes. One thing I want to say about Len Ward, her partner, which they have their like big, I love their showdown at the end of the book. It's literally like a cowboy, like old Wild West movies, a showdown. They're both facing each other and it's so momentous.
Like quick draw.
Yeah, it's literally like a quick draw thing where she's standing up for herself, finally against him. He's drawing the way that Elsa draws him, like the way evil has corrupted him, is so nuts. Because this also, the first time I read it, I realized he was the same guy with the thinner mustache in the flashbacks with, at first I thought there were two different characters. And then I just realized his life of crime in these years have turned him into the guy with the big mustache. It looks almost unrecognizable from his older self.
Same with the other guy. Like I thought like they look very similar, but I was like, okay, the one is thin and one is not. And it was like, okay, this time I realized, wait, they are the same person. It's just different times.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's incredibly like subtly done. Like I can see why a lot of people thought like volume one was incredibly confusing, because it kind of is, but also like you kind of know that there's something big planned, right? Like, so I felt safe. I didn't feel like my confusion was unintentional, let's say, you know?
I felt like they give you just enough to keep you interested, but you're almost like, I have no idea what's going on. I don't know if I should invest into this, but they give you just enough that you want to, and then it all starts coming together more and more to the point where you're like, oh, hell yeah, this is fucking sick. Like, by the time you're halfway through.
Yeah. No, and I think in the first volume, particularly, the dialogue is what is essentially, like, in the writing, it's the dialogue and obviously the artwork that is going to take you to the next volume. So it's really
like
well
Tarantino. Crafted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the three main characters, too, how it's like, you know, they do all have like this common thread of their like women who've been kind of like beaten up by the world and are kind of broken humans, but they all have their very own personalities and are actual like good people on the inside.
Yeah. I liked how complex they were. Really? I liked how, I mean, even with Dee in the end, like she kind of makes the wrong choice, but the story doesn't really judge her for it. Like it tries to understand her more than anything else. So no, that was very nice. Yeah.
That tragic scene with the dancer. That's the part that like I have stuck in my mind about this whole series forever. Like there's something that was so heartbreaking of her. Like, I got to get out of here. I got all this money. Come with me. And then she's like, well, what's my name? And then she's just like, Dancer, baby. And it's like, it's heartbreaking because you know that like, that is her only escape. And the only thing she knows is how to use money to get something. And even this amount of money can't buy her the like affection that she thought she was getting. And that dancer thought she was like had with her. Oh, but yeah, and I didn't feel bad for Dee. I didn't hate Dee in that moment. If anything, there was that insane sense of like empathy and pity over like, of course this is how it's been. This is like flirting with a barista. That's their job. Yeah. And even if they like you back, you should learn about them or do something about them. It's amazing. Like you said, the characterization and everything that this book is able to do, even when we only know them by how we've encountered them and what's happened to them thus far in the story is gorgeous.
Yeah. Coming back to the color though, like I think I found it, like I wonder how much discussion there was on the color, because there are certain things which are, which seem like they would be instructions that these things would be told to Matt. And there are other things which I'm sure like Matt added by himself because he's a very smart colorist, right? And I wonder if the palette for all four volumes was planned out in advance before anybody executed the first volume even. You can sort of see it kind of ramping up. Like you can see the storytelling and the color ramping up over volumes. I mean, again, like having listened to Fraction interviews, I have a feeling that it might have actually been planned out, but like, I don't know. I would love to know that. Maybe I should ask Elsa about this. Yeah.
Maybe. I feel like it definitely had to be planned out. Even just from that very first volume, the very first story with the contrast, that bright red of the light above the door that she's imagining against the like cool blue of the rest of the scene is such a like, wow, like a pop of like, this is important. And then as it really hits, it's like, that was very, very important.
Yeah. But, yeah. There's also like the red in, I think the last volume, where, you see the Mr. Man, you see him trying to buy a gun.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Man. I love that.
That's a third volume. One of the ending is so pathetic. Like he comes controlling Dee's life and he's kind of
cathartic,
like
cathartic though.
Yeah, it's very cathartic because he's their first like enemy we meet and kind of controls Dee's life, puts her in all his danger, beats her with her crutch. I mean, we obviously meet worse people like Glenn Ward ends up being and kind of more of a vicious animal, but at his end when Ward are after him, he just becomes his cathartic as he becomes just a pathetic coward for getting couldn't buy the gun because he had to do the waiting list, tries to go to a hotel room, you got him, like, just completely out of all luck.
Yeah.
No, and here's something I noticed, like, there are some chapters in the book where the blank panels get replaced by storytelling from a different section of the book. And that happens with Emma Rosa, I think, a couple of times, where one of the times those three are, like, the kite flying away, and the fourth panel there is, like, Emma Rosa standing alone. You know, like those are like so in like they're all done with color. Like this is all like you can't really do this without understanding how you're using color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Like wait, let me try and find. Yeah, you look at this one. Like there's just blue and yellow and red.
Yeah.
And oh, that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Ah, such a good book. Like I have no idea why. Actually, I kind of know why this didn't do as well as I think they hoped, because of like the release schedule did get a little messed up, right? So I believe, like I think with volume 2, their copies did not come from China, and I think they had to get it reprinted or something.
Oh dang!
Yeah.
Oh okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, a lot of the pandemic stuff happened for particularly for volume 2, I believe. Yeah. But also, like, you buy the book and Fraction talks about how good the paper smells, and it does smell lovely.
Mm-hmm.
The paper smells incredible. Yeah, I love all books.
Yeah, he actually really like goes into the stuff. He actually chooses. And I'm sure that didn't help the cost, because with image, essentially, you're paying for all of these things. Like, you're paying for them later, but like if you choose a better quality paper, that means you get paid less.
Yeah.
Like that's how that works, right? So they chose like everything, like, you know, top tier stuff for everything. And then obviously they had to kind of, I guess, pay for it. So
I mean, it pays off, because the actual like cover of it is gorgeous. And I really, there's something to be said about books where the hardcovers like this, where it's all trade dress. Like I don't need a dust jacket. It's just like right there. And then there's like, even like that feeling of the story being told a little bit just from the cover.
You have the, double images, like, you know, two images going on top mm-hmm. of each other here. And then like, I think it's either the same two images or the same color scheme at the back.
Yep.
Yeah. There's also embossing on the title.
Ah, that's also one of my favorites. When you can run your hand over it and like feel it. Yeah.
You can feel it. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of old Stephen King novels when I was a kid. Like, you know, that
I remember getting those from the library. I'd ride my bike. We were like maybe a block and a half from a library. So I'd ride my bike up there like every week in the summer and just tear through like another Stephen King novel. But I do remember like being able to feel the title on all of them, basically. So good.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I love those.
That's a refreshment. Like my summers and growing up and like elementary school, all about Stephen King too. In middle school and high school, he's like, let me get the next King mm-hmm. novel I haven't read. It's a great part of growing up.
Yeah, I think
up.
The same here. Like
I kind of have subjects, but I wish I could.
Yeah, I mean, most of my reading from the age of 12 to 16 was probably Stephen King.
Me too. He released like 3 or 4 books this year alone, and like, then I'm like, maybe I'll try to read them, but then I realize I haven't read any stuff for like 8 years.
I would suggest reading Revival. Like I think that's like a late period masterpiece from him. It is genuinely fantastic. Like I read 3 or 4 of his recent books, and that's the one that really stood out for me.
Yeah, I heard a lot of praise for Revival. That's the one I've heard like the most praise for. It's already been
Mike Flanagan tried to adapt it. Like there's a script floating around somewhere, but I wasn't able to find it.
Yeah, and Josh Boone before him was the other big King adapter. The mutants, and they did the Stand Revival. He was trying to do it with Russell Crowe and Samuel L. Jackson, and then that never took off either. But
it's a very bleak book, so maybe
that's the King adaptions aren't done too well.
But he makes, I think there's something to be said, right, about, sure, the quality of some of them, not so good. But the fact that he will sell the rights to make them for $1 to like people that come to him and say like, I love this story, check this pitch out, and he's like, great, give me a buck and go ahead.
So I believe the idea is that for student filmmakers, like, so the people who are not going to make any money out of them, mm-hmm. he sells them for $1. Like you're just supposed to write him an email and like send $1 with it.
Yeah.
But like proper rights sales, like he actually does get money for them.
But just the idea that like he's not afraid of like, he writes a book and then somebody makes a movie. Whether that movie's good, bad, or indifferent, King don't care. Just keep making different movies of them. You know what I mean? In the same way that I wish superhero stuff would go sometimes, right? Give me 4 different styles of Batman movie. Make one that's like the super dark, crazy, gritty, whatever realistic take that everyone's clamoring for all the time. And then give me one that's not that. Give me one where it's like crazy superhero rich guy gadget stuff or whatever. Like, you know, like even if you want to, sure. Or back. Like Superman. You want to make a cool
I watched the Harley Quinn TV show. I watched the Harley Quinn TV show. The first season of that was like so much more interesting than most of the movies.
It's so funny. And like the Legion of Doom is hilarious. The idea of them just like having a, where do they get all their money? Oh, they pitch their idea and then they get funding from the other members. Like, all right, yeah, I like that, you know?
There's
just something to be said about like embrace every element of the material and let other people decide what they like. Who cares?
Yeah. Also, like King says that, I mean, he says that like the books are still there, right? Like the movie might not have been good or whatever, but the book is the book. Which I feel that about Watchmen. Like there might have been other stuff, but the book is the book.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as the original Watchmen for me. There's just one Watchmen.
Right.
Yeah. Also, I think maybe with why King stuff doesn't adapt well into movies is because a lot of it is like people's internal monologue and thought patterns and stuff that doesn't translate to the screen very well.
Yeah, it's prose after all. So
yeah.
Like he really uses the medium. Yeah. Yeah, I think pardon me?
I was gonna say a lot of independent comics even Watchmen issue with adapting is the same thing where a lot of it is word bubbles and a lot of storytelling is you kind of hearing our characters' thoughts or the narrative. Or I don't know, unless you wanna like I was thinking about Criminal. Why hasn't there ever been a Criminal movie or TV show? And then like I reread Criminal a lot and I'm like the whole story would have to be someone doing a voiceover. Yeah. Like it had to be narrated, but telling the story.
Or yeah, I had an interview recently with an Indian concept artist who was trying to kind of like, you know more about comics. And he tried to ask me like, he was like, okay, what is the thing that comics can give you that no other medium can? And Watchmen is a great example of that because when Terry Gilliam tried to adapt it, he basically came back and said that this is unadaptable. Like this is unfilmable. And the reason for that was like, this is a guy who's done Brazil, which is like full of in jokes all over the screen. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that the way there is imagery seeded throughout Watchmen that you can look at, like, you know, the who watches the Watchmen thing is not completely visible till like a few, pages into the book at least. And there are these circle motifs that kind of keep repeating, the biohazard symbol, et cetera, et cetera. So he was like, you know, those things play up such a big part of the storytelling that I can't really just put them on the film because film goes by at 24 frames a second. But with a comic, you can turn back the pages. You can, like, if you notice something that on page 84 and you think that it might link back to something on page 36, you can just turn back and you can just check like how it links back. And that's how I fell in love with Watchmen. Like the first time I read it, I didn't really think it was such a big deal. But the second time I was reading it, I started noticing all these things. And I suddenly started like, you know, reading it as like a, jumping from like part to part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fun thing about comics, that while they're a visual medium, they're also all available to you at once. Like it's a, you know, that Grant Morrison's flattened time thing where, you know, the entire thing is there for you to look at pour through throughout. And that's something that comics can do that film can't really do. Like same with November even. Like there are these motifs that you only notice when you start like comparing the pages, like looking, like, you know, putting them side by side and looking at them. Oh, they're doing the same thing in this one. You know, that kind of stuff.
Definitely. Like what you said earlier about November, how you noticed like the panels were showing Emma Rose's kind of scenes come in the middle instead of blank panels. The first like volume, which you said was confusing to a lot of people. So many panels in that are from later volumes, like just flashes of what's happening.
Oh, yeah,
to D, like,
I didn't notice that this time.
And there's
time,
flashes of what's happening to Dee at the end after she's kidnapped. You see flashes throughout the later story. So I could see someone that reading it the first time. I mean, I love mysteries and puzzle box. So me, once they just start with that conversation with her, man, I'm sucked in. I'm like, I got to figure out what's going on. But for someone that maybe isn't as wants to be more straightforward, told a story, I can see that confusing because so many pieces you see of the story are from later parts in the story, because
Or no, I think chronologically, later, it's actually like, not later because
nothing in this.
No, it's not actually later because that's the part later, where she misses one day and he comes and like beats her up. Right, so it's already happened, but previous. You only that's see previous. That scene in a later one.
Yeah.
No, I think the puzzle box thing is quite interesting because usually I'm not a fan of puzzle box storytelling because it tends not to be satisfying. Like you have Westworld, for example, or Lost. Like these things, they ask you to analyze them so much that in the end, I put in more effort than sometimes the creator has. Not me personally, but like in Westworld's case, the internet, essentially like Reddit as a whole.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, I did that with Lost.
But you're, like, there is no...
For years and then...
I think the interesting thing is that... Well, the coherent thing is these women's story, right? And that is the important thing. So even if you don't really connect the rest of it, that just kind of makes for a... interesting world for the story to happen in. So even though there is a puzzle that can be put together, it's not necessarily one that's meant to be solved, so to speak, because that's not the important thing, right?
Definitely. It's more, the important thing is how these women survive and how they get through this night in November. Another thing I love about the main core of the story is seeing how they all react to this same situation differently throughout the story, especially last volume. And third and last volume of both volumes, where we see them all react to when Kowalski gets there, the last volume, and you get to see all their thoughts run through their head, and all of them like thinking, what's
like Emma Rose is saying, of like she's so frustrated. Yeah, why isn't everybody just working together?
My favorite scene in the book, though, is in the third volume when Kowalski, in the very beginning of the third volume, when Kowalski goes after she grabs her gun from her house, and her wife calls her, and there's the scene where her wife's talking to her. You know, kind of asking what she's doing. She's not a real cop anymore. And the way that Elsa during the scene.
Yeah, the wife is in shadow and like she slowly comes out of. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Covered. Yeah, she's in shadow. Yes, and how she slowly comes out of shadow. And then like finally at the end, Kowalski just, you know, telling her wife the truth, what's going on, like telling her what's connected, which obviously leaves her in a shocked state. And just kind of how powerful we've seen Kowalski journey just from the beginning of the story. When she goes, you know, cop stuff, a perfect way to end the scene.
But also, I loved
like,
how she's handled I loved how, you know, the telephone conversation starts as if Kowalski's wife is going to be like a nagging wife, but she constantly refuses to be that.
Yeah.
Like, that is not who she is. And as the scene goes, her face is revealed. So, like, I always almost thought as if, like, on purpose, she starts off as a cipher, and then by the end of that conversation, she's revealed as a character, right? Like there's a very interesting thing because that's the only scene she really gets.
Awesome.
Like other than that, she's not really in the book. But I think Fraction and Elsa wanted to kind of really make her appearance like impactful, so they really showed how this is a person, like just like these people who are on the ancillary, like they are the ancillary parts of somebody else's story, but they are real people. Just like that, the ancillary portion of their story is also a real person. Same with Dancer. Like when Dancer finally comes, she refuses to be the character that Dee wants her to be. Right.
Yeah.
So that's, I really love that stuff. Like that's Emma Rose in a whole, like she is the innocent bystander character who just has a whole other life. Like even when she gets out, even when she finally gets out, she completes her delivery before leaving.
Yeah.
And that was my favorite moment of the character moment of the book, where like, no, I'm supposed to deliver these groceries. I'm going to do that.
Such a good sign. I literally was just about to bring that part up. Like she's literally on the run. Of course she's going to do her job.
Yeah.
She's originally out there to do.
Great. Man, there's so many tiny moments in these books that just like so full of humanity.
And they're so she's like, well, fuck this, I'm out.
Grabs
as much money as I can hold.
I love all the characters. I would say Kowalski and Emma Rose kind of get me more, even though Dee's obviously a very strong character and kind of our main introduction to the whole story. But just Kowalski's heart and Emma's like personality, that she would finish her job and like her ever will to be free. Like just... The moment she's captured and put in there, Dee's scared shitless, she's immediately trying to get out of the rope. It's like, I'm getting out of here. Like, no. She tries to get out in the trunk, too.
She constantly will not be caged. Even at the end, like, she knows, like, there's the possibility that somebody might come looking for her, and she's aware of it. But she's not going to let it limit her. Like, that's not going to be how I live my life. Like, that's just such a fantastic choice.
And her trying to get them, the other characters, to motivate, like, Kowalski, like, we got to get out of here. What are you doing right now?
And I'm just thinking about what you said about Watchmen still. Like, it's been kicking around in my head. Because I do remember reading that similar quote about, like, it's unfilmable. You can't fast forward or rewind a movie while you're watching it in theaters. When it comes out at home, you could go back, you could rewind and say, oh, there it is, or there that moment was. But yeah, it's moving forward. That's the visual part of it. But you describing flipping back and forth between like something I saw here and connecting it to something I saw there made me realize that that story in essence makes you Dr. Manhattan in a way.
Yep, yep. I think that's like something through. That Moore actually talked about.
Oh, dang. Yeah.
That you can go to any panel of the story at any time and like, but it's there, it's immutable, you can't change it, but it's there.
Right. Yeah. All that power, nothing to do with it.
Yeah. That's the Dr. Manhattan chapter as well, right? Like it's mm-hmm. you kind of see all these glimpses that again, like are in other chapters, I think. Like some of those panels do recur in other chapters. And they're just like him looking at his life and can't like I mean, it is that, right? Like you have a whole slab of time that you can't change, but you can go to any part of it at any point.
Yeah.
And this is not new to me. This is Morrison. Like this is Grant Morrison in several interviews talking about why comics are amazing.
Right. Yeah. He's got the right idea about him. That's for sure.
I listened to that Hickman and Morrison interview yesterday. That was really fun.
Yeah. Was it good? Oh man.
Yeah.
I got to figure out if I'm doing that. I don't know that I'm doing Substack. I'm thinking about it, but I'm hesitant.
Right. Let's say. Well, I'm sort of involved in one, so no comment beyond that. Beyond that, I understand the concerns. Man.
Blue book. That was the first selling point for me. Was Blue Book
at least and then one of James's books for Substack. Nice. So
very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I might be working on more, but I can't tell you that.
That's okay.
Sorry.
I like suspense. I like surprise.
You're part of the main pitch of Blue Book. When I said it, it was like, oh, Aditya is lettering it and Michael Avon Oeming, and it's about UFOs, which I love. Like, that was like a lot of James' stuff just seems like I think we're on the same age. I seem like a lot of things that interest him are like conspiracy based UFOs.
I don't know if these posts are free or not, but there are two process posts of James and Michael just talking about UFOs. And I'm not a UFO guy, like exactly, but that was just so fascinating. Like their personal connections to UFOs, like how they feel about the entire history of UFOs, how it connects to American history.
Yeah, that's public.
That's fantastic stuff. Yeah.
Their own connections here. Michael tell a story about, I think it was his mother or grandmother about how.
I think his mother and
aunt. When they encountered a UFO. Yeah, just really, really cool stuff. I've been enjoying just the Substack reading. Ben and Hickman and all that stuff has been, I mean, really interesting. Seeing all the process on Three Worlds, Three Moons, too, from fun. Mike Dunlendo.
Yeah, and I've been discussing, how this new medium can be used. Like, it's not a new medium exactly. It's just webcomics. But still, like, it's a different delivery mechanism for an audience that hasn't traditionally used that particular mechanism, right? And like, it's been quite interesting seeing like where things can go. I think formally Hickman's thing is kind of the most interesting to me because he's kind of, okay, the comics are only part of the experience and he's trying to design the rest of the experience as well. While for the others, the rest of the experience is just text or video or whatever it is, right? But for Hickman, it's like, oh, I get to essentially build an entire world in public. And I get to design it as it kind of comes out. It's almost like performance art, I feel.
That's what intrigues me the most, too. Yeah. And now, like, Rom and, you know, Al and Tiny are all helping him with all those different systems, the religion, the economy, the magic.
Yeah, I believe they all, like, just wrote a single document. They wrote a document for the... So it's like in D&D where sometimes, like, they go, okay, you do the fighting thing, you do the how money works, you do how religion works, you do how magic works. It's kind of like that, where like, at least in Ram's case, I know that he's just written like one document about the financial system and kind of sent it along to Hickman.
And just building the whole universe.
And then it depends on Hickman.
And his concept of making almost like any comic universe we know, where this is just the building pieces and he wants other people to come in and also work in this universe. Yeah, it's a very interesting experiment. But I mean, I'm excited for both him and Tinian's books. Chip has a lot of interesting stuff too. I haven't read any of the other Substack newsletters yet because these were people I was already following, Hickman and Tinian. So I'm excited to see.
I subscribed to the Hickman one and I got a complimentary pass to the Tinian one because I'm working on it. Other than that, I've already signed up to too many newsletters, so I didn't really need any more reading.
Enough is enough.
Also, I love newsletters as a format for a really long time. Like I'm a very early adopter to newsletters, and I've been signed up to like tech newsletters and weird people writing like psychogeography newsletters and stuff like that. All of that's fun.
I just started setting up my email list newsletter stuff and starting to realize how just effective it is, like as a way to reach people directly.
So I have a newsletter, right? And it's not very regular, but I find the idea of like, okay, here's an audience who's gonna get, like they've chosen to get exactly what you're sending them. Right. And they've allowed you into their inbox. So like there's a certain responsibility that you feel about it. And there's a certain sort of intimacy to it because like, it's almost like even more than a blog, like these people are like, they've chosen to listen to you. Really? Like a blog can be visited. Yep. A newsletter, sure, it can be visited, but most of the time it's going to just be accessed through email.
It's also like, right, so if you're reaching out directly into this person's inbox, you're not going to give them crap. You're going to give them something they're interested in and something engaging.
Yeah. That's actually why I don't post that frequently, because I feel that responsibility of if I'm sending you something, it needs to be something that's going to be worth your time.
I saw something interesting that an artist I really look up to was saying about his music and how a lot of musicians are like scared to post too much and end up not posting very much. Mm. And he's like, well, I'd rather just post all the time. And so that there's a large body of work so you can find a median. And that's what I've been trying to kind of focus more on, is having like a larger body of work where there's like a center point for everything. So like some stuff will be better, some will be worse.
I think you need to strike a balance. Yeah.
Selective too.
Like, I don't think it's a bad idea. I don't think it's a bad idea to do. Sorry.
Oh yeah. I was going to say, you also have to be selective though. I was just being too selective for a while.
Yeah. I definitely I think prolificness is useful. But also you don't want to spread yourself so thin that like you've made 7 different commitments and they have nothing to do with what you really want to be doing with your career or whatever it is. I have this conversation with Ram quite a bit where he's like, I'm okay with missing newsletters because for me, writing the comics and writing the stories is what's really important.
Yep.
So the newsletter is a way to kind of help people become aware of them, but they can't become the point ever. So for me, I tried to figure out a good format for my newsletter, and I landed on this technical handbook thing, which I've only done one post of, but like this is what I want to put out in the world apart from my work, which is I want to help new people understand how the medium works and how the industry works. And this is my way of like, this is the experience that I've had that I can share with you. But other than that and the work, I can't like be telling stories in my newsletter. I can't be writing essays. I can't be forcing out an essay every week.
Exactly.
Just because the newsletter is there, because I would rather be writing a story or I would rather be lettering a comic, you know?
Yeah. I think that's kind of how I'm trying to view it with my artistic stuff, is like putting out the art itself is number one. And then I'm trying to focus more on like, doing like YouTube tutorials and putting out products that people can buy and stuff as second, so that I can like afford to be a human, and then everything else is behind that.
Quality, not quantity.
Exactly. Like it's cool to spread out and do other things, but you gotta prioritize.
Yeah, I think the hustle economy kind of asks us to keep doing too much.
Mm-hmm.
But it sadly has become our responsibility that we don't. You know, like, I mean, there are people who...
Capitalism, am I right?
Yeah, yeah, because everything is, like, everything outside you is telling you that you need to be producing more. But the fact is, that's going to bleed you dry at some point of time. Like, we all know the genius maverick writer who got sucked into, like, the corporate system and then at some point of time is putting out, like, 8 books a month or whatever. And then they start repeating themselves. They start repeating themes. You need time to recharge. You need time to grow. You need time to like edit, you know, like you need time to like, you can't just be sending out the first draft of everything. You have to be able to like hone things. And like that becomes your responsibility because everybody around you just wants you to do more. I mean, that happened to me for a couple of years, right? Like in 2019 and 2020, I was like, all the assignments I was getting were really interesting and I was saying yes to most of them, but then it became my responsibility to do them at the best of my ability. And that just meant that I was working for like 14, 15 hours a day. Right. And it's my responsibility to know that, okay, I can't do that. So I need to cut down. Yeah. Definitely. Actually, coming back to November, I think Fraction is a very wise person there. Like he really conserves his time. Like he really, like knows that, okay, I have this much time and this is how much I can do with it. So like, and obviously his family is important to him. So he's going to spend a lot of time taking care of his family. And then he does the work. And you know, that's really wise for me.
I think kind of relating to what we were talking about is like, if you look at Italians and how they can drink red wine and eat fatty foods all the time, but they still live longer than us because they work shorter days with like larger, you know, breaks, because it's like in the culture it's understood that, you know, rest will keep you healthy and make you even more productive during the time you spend.
Less drained when you're actually creating what you want to create, not just doing it out of like repeated pattern. I loved it about
for the capitalist grind.
Yeah, it's nice to see him like, you know, take his money to breaks and then come back too, because then when he comes back, now each story is going to be unique and really like interesting and draws me in.
I mean, Adventure Man is nothing like November.
Not at all. And, I mean, even Jimmy Olsen.
No.
Is he doing anything else? Is that a third book or is that just...
The only books he has... No, Adventure Man, Jimmy Olsen, and November were all...
Oh, Jimmy Olsen.
Projects he did around the same time. I've heard... I'm excited for whatever he announced next, because he probably, you know, takes the good time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which I could understand.
I
was just going to say, which I can understand a lot what we were just talking about, because like me, like I just took a new shift, which is overnight, and I get to work at home, which is nice because I get to spend time with my baby. And like sacrificing for any work, your entire, like, I just can't imagine people in like the 50s that were never around their kids. Like we're just gone 10 hours a day. And I just couldn't.
Yeah.
That's worth that. Like I understand working, making a living, even doing what you're passionate about, but like, I would never not want to be here for like my daughter growing up or not have those moments. It's just things you can't get back. So it's just crazy that we as society sacrificed that so willingly in the past.
Yeah.
It's these moments that are like, you know, you can't get it back, which I really understand Fraction, man. He has kids and a family. I'm sure a lot of times he wants to make sure, you know, he's spending time with them. And his, I don't know if it was Twitter, Instagram, not Instagram anymore, but I think it was Instagram, or him and Kelly, they have a lot of fun photos of their kids. Like their Halloween pictures, great. They're always doing something fun, and like seeing how much of a family man he is nice. I think are important besides work. And, you know, it's really to kind of take those times we need, even as people, any relationships, kind of make sure we have them as well. Enjoy life. So it's great to see him take breaks. Milligan too, off subject. It's great to see Milligan come back this year too. It kind of reminds me of Fraction. Back in 2019, he came back. Milligan for me didn't write for a while. He was just doing those Britannia books. I don't know if he took breaks.
Oh, right.
No,
I did a book with him at Black Crown called Kid Lobotomy in, I think, 2017, 2018.
Oh, wow. I don't even know about that. That's good to know. So.
Oh, yeah. I remember that one.
It's a nice book. It's quite weird. It's very interesting. I see what you mean. I think you got to take that like time off. And I think that leads to, I think one of, so I was talking to another writer about this, and we were talking about how like you can't really nail down who Fraction is as a writer, like unlike so many other writers. Like, you know, you can kind of tell who Moore is. You can kind of tell who Ennis is. you can kind of tell who Bendis is. All these people have like a, they have an identity as a writer. And Fraction, I think, just like does different things and he does them differently. They don't sound the same. His dialogue doesn't sound the same in each of them. Like it's quite fascinating to me as a writer because that's simultaneously difficult, but also it's a little worrying. Like if I was a writer and if people told me like, hey, I don't know what your voice is, I that would be a little worrying to me. Like because I would be like, I want to be identified at least. Yeah. A little. You know,
even with this miniseries, that's so obvious. Even go back a couple episodes, it's crazy that this, or even Hawkeye last week, the same writer who did Invincible Iron Man. It's not.
Yeah, exactly. Like they don't read the same at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Casanova doesn't read like any of those things. And I think, so the writer I was talking to was like, so do you mean that he doesn't put himself into his art? And I was like, I don't think that's the case because I think every story that he does is personal to a large degree. And sometimes he is like, it's not like he's a very, you know, reserved writer either, because I remember when Casanova was serializing, he would talk about very difficult things that he was going through, like in the back matter of Casanova. Mm-hmm. So it's not like he's somebody who tries to keep himself out of the public eye exactly. So I wonder like, so even November, like it doesn't read like anything else he's done really. That's so fascinating to me. Like how a writer can just be like, I mean, it's not even a chameleon thing. It's like I don't know what Fraction as a whole wants to say about the word.
Yeah. He serves the story in the best way possible.
Yeah.
Like whatever the story is, he's meeting its needs through its dialogue and everything without relying on the same tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely know where you're coming from.
Yeah. That's it's quite interesting. I like that. He does have those blank panels he uses a lot. Yeah. Like that's like one writerly tick he has, I would say. But other than that, and that's a good trick. I mean, I like I'm going to steal that for stuff. So
I would say his most similar stories to me, even though they're not that similar, would probably be Jimmy Olsen and Hawkeye. Even though those two stories aren't that similar, Hawkeye's got way more of a serious edge throughout it and comedy. It's got like kind of the same.
It's very grounded, yeah.
Yeah, like Hawkeye's. Granted, Jimmy Olsen. Jimmy Olsen's like
you. Literally have a building in Hawkeye as well. Like there's a building that he's trying to.
Yeah, it's an apartment. It brings Hawkeye down to like ground level, but like the kind of humor of Hawkeye, the upbeat. You know, when it is humorous, kind of when Kate travels to LA and stuff, kind of like the bizarre off humor that at least happens in the LA portion of the book. Parts of the New York story as well kind of remind me of some of the bizarre stuff that happens to Jimmy Olsen. But
in Jimmy Olsen, yeah,
he has
I think humor is that kind of thing. I don't think you can tell jokes like another person. I think your sense of humor is always going to be yours. So yeah, there's that.
This one and Hawkeye also were a lot faster reads than I expected for the amount of body they had, just because everything was so like fast paced.
November was such a nice break for us though. Like, from I mean, all of the stuff that we've talked about thus far has been some of my like favorite runs of those characters, right? Like, I don't think I'll read a Hawkeye run that will make me feel the same way that Hawkeye run did. I've read Cantwell's Iron Man is pretty close, I think, the Iron Man that's going on right now, to the feel of Invincible Iron Man that I would say I got.
Actually, that was one that I never really got into. Like, I read it, but I don't think it made much of an impact on me. But then I really love Extremis. So that's my Iron Man.
I love that as
that's
well.
A real good one too. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like that was like getting to read an MCU like movie before everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that yeah. But Casanova, at least the first two or three volumes were just brilliant. I think it lost the plot a little towards like later. I don't know what's kind of going on in Casanova at the moment.
I just remember
the first two or three volumes are just brilliant.
Going to a different universe and taking his self spot who had died or something. And then there was like time travel maybe. And everybody knew that it wasn't their Casanova, but was pretending that it wasn't their Casanova. Or there's something weird where like, I definitely agree that there is a certain point where I remember being like, did I read any of this? I definitely read like 12 issues or so, but why do I not know what's happening anymore?
Yeah, the first volume was much more focused as well because it was kind of trying to do one aspect of pop culture. Like, I mean, it was a little like Planetary, right? Mm-hmm. Where it was doing like one, like, okay, we'll do Super Spies this time. We'll do like Killer Robots this time. We'll do like the like colonialist idea of a hidden island this time, you know, that kind of stuff. And then after volume two, like, you kind of don't know where that's going either. Like, it's kind of one story, but I don't know what the story is.
Yeah.
The art remains fantastic.
Of course. Yeah. You can't beat those brothers.
Yeah. Like, I think November's just, I think it's probably my favorite thing by Fraction. It's just, it's focused. It's like clear. It's incredibly well written. And just like everything he does, it's very well produced.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it's like, this is my ideal Fraction so far.
Engaging too, I would say.
Yeah. Like, I read the first one and I was just electrified. I was just like, oh, this is new. This feels different.
Yeah. I sat down to read one little piece of it. I was like, I can't read the whole book right now. I'll read like the first story. I'll put the bookmark in it. And then the next, I was late for whatever it was I was supposed to be doing. Cause I was like, nah, I'm gonna finish this. I got to finish this volume. I got to know what's going on. And then two, yeah. Three, four, same thing. Every time I was like, well, reserve this whole night. I'm reading the volume. I'm doing it.
Almost every time I read it, even when I was reading it now, I was like, I'm nice. Going to read
yeah.
half right now. And then I'm going to read the other half closer to recording. And then yeah, I just couldn't stop. It's just, yeah, it's such an engaging read and so nice to pick up more stuff.
It's a recurring theme of Fraction, I feel like, is we'll just read six issues. We'll just read like a little bit of it. Well, actually I ended up reading 12 or 15 because I just couldn't stop.
Yeah, I tend to read a lot of like novels and stuff, you know, so that can be a pretty big time sink. Especially the nonfiction ones. Yeah. Those ones can be a lot to get
through.
True.
And I think you can go back and look through it quite a bit. I think there's always going to be more details that you're going to connect. But fundamentally, they are fairly like quick moving stories. Like they're not confusing stories. Like, I mean, not even confusing. I would say they're very propellant stories. They're like, they have a pace to them. Like they have a crunch to them.
They're very well paced. That's I think another trying to identify Fraction things. He has a masterful control over pace, I think.
Like
everything I've read from him is always well paced for sure.
Yeah. And I think so I was like, I mean, me and my collaborators keep talking about grids all the time because the creator, a grid is always very interesting. And like the 12 panel grid here, I love how time gets sliced in those 12 panels because it's not the same way it would get sliced in 9 panels or 8 panels or 16 panels. Like there's an entire page where it's just like one person coming out of a car or something like that. And still you're kind of in the moment, you're kind of like waiting with bated breath. Like they're trying to create a pace of suspense and it happens. Like you really feel that, you know, somebody's waiting for somebody to see like, okay, who's going to be the one who opens this door. Right. And that 12 panel thing is, it's really like masterfully paced. Like there's, at first you're always like kind of cutting very quickly between dialogue. And then every time the action happens much more slowly. But then as you go further into the book, you kind of cut between scenes quite a bit when action is happening. So the action also feels more frenetic because there are fewer like panels in which the action is taking place. So there's a lot of these like small choices that they're making with the pacing of the book. That's very nice. And then so when that happens, and then again, when you kind of are in one place, and then when you're again kind of going from aspect to aspect or like, you know, shot to shot, then it kind of feels like it's all slowed down again. Like it's damn nice.
Yeah.
It's comics. I love comics.
Right now I'm on that. I mean, you're a fan too of comics. I'm on that kick right now where I'm trying to read everything possible for my end of the year list in December. So I'm like, I have to read every indie book. I have to read 10 new books a week that,
yeah. Oh, I stopped trying to do that, sadly, because I can't keep up. I'm working too much of the time. And these days I'm reading a lot more prose. So like comics have been much more rare, but I've been trying to catch up in some. But also, like, I remember the first time I read Providence, I skipped the prose pages. I think I read the prose pages the third time I was reading it, because they are like the handwriting, it's really well lettered, like it's excellent lettering, but it's a lot to take in when you're just like reading what somebody else has written. But then you start realizing how much it reflects on the issue, how much it is like Robert Black trying to talk himself out of what he has seen. And like, you just see him kind of experience something and then talk himself back to normality. And it's just, it is really good. I'm waiting for my print compendium. I had it delivered to Denny's in the US. He's going to send it to me.
That's awesome. It's beautiful. I got it yesterday and I was like, yes. And then like, yeah, I've only read it digital before this. So like having it finally.
Same here, because I don't think it was available.
No, I don't think so either.
So I just got that digital compendium as well, which is apparently there's a few revisions in it.
Yeah.
Like they fixed a few typos and stuff like that. But yeah, before this, I read the Comixology singles.
Yeah, it's.
I think that was the only format available.
It's with Burroughs Arts. I mean, it's so good. Everything about it. Like, as soon as I got it, like, I was like, yes. And I read just last week The Courtyard and Neonomicon, knowing it was coming. So I was like, get the whole experience.
Yeah.
Then the pamphlets too, like Sujim's pamphlets that he gets from him.
Yeah.
And then like those, like you'll get Robert Black's writings in his Commonplace book. Then you'll get like a 15-page pamphlet where you get to read about it. And it adds so much to everything you hear about. And like every part of like real historical fiction, most of these characters were real and really did these things and are what inspired H.P. Lovecraft to create his book. So like the way Moore just, you know, like blends fiction with reality is just, it's so good and so creepy. Like it's a book every time I read it and I start thinking about my weird dream.
And there's so much research there. Like if you read the annotations, like those, so the, I think it's the annotations blog is called Facts in the Case of Providence. So like that's an annotations blog where they go through each issue and like tell you like who that background character there was from H.P. Lovecraft's books and stuff like that, or like which story is being referred to and things like that. And that is how I finally got into H.P. Lovecraft in the first place, because I kind of had no interest in Lovecraft, but then I read Providence and I loved it. I was like, how much more would I love this if I knew what more stuff?
That's the same way for me. When I originally was reading Providence, I bought like this book I have it where it's all of Lovecraft's story in one tome. And that's how I got into Lovecraft too. I was like, I know who he is. I read like maybe two of his stories in high school. I always thought they were kind of slow when I was younger and couldn't really get to these parts of horror because I had a hard time getting through them. And then finally got to read them, you know, my early 30s, go back and read it when I was reading Providence and be like, okay, I understand now why people do like Lovecraft. Like he kind of invented, you know, a lot of parts.
Yeah, and
I think
reading Lovecraft as a teenager is a little dangerous, I feel, because you won't be as suspicious of you won't be as suspicious of his worldview. But like while I was reading it in my 30s, like I could see that, for example, like the Red Hook story was. Like, it was just incredibly racist.
Yeah, no, that's just like I was talking about that earlier before we recorded. I was like, you know, as a teenager, I never noticed the racism. When I started reading again, I'm like, this is incredibly racist.
There you go. but then it's really cool when you read, like, Victor Laval's The Ballad of Black Tom, which is kind of a rewrite of Red Hook from the point of view of, like, I don't think it's even a minor character. He kind of inserts a minor character into the story and makes it his story. And then you read that and you realize, okay, like this is how you engage with Lovecraft's fiction. So, and I think you can do those things better as an adult than as a teenager or something like that. Like even Neonomicon, I understand that it's an incredibly unpleasant book.
That's what Chaz is saying. But, I still enjoy it. But
it's meant to be unpleasant. It's like it's not written to be more pleasant. Like Moore isn't trying to give you a fluffy yarn from his point of view. Like it's supposed to be a upsetting read. And obviously like how moral that is or how okay that is or whatever. I mean, each person will have their own opinion, but like what Moore is trying to do is to put all the racism and sexism on the page. Right. And yet not necessarily approve of it.
Yeah.
So, and that's a very intricate balancing act. Like I think Neonomicon is a very, very well-written book.
Yeah.
It's a very unpleasant book.
Yeah, it's very unpleasant.
It's like you can't deny the work.
And with you know, Providence and Courtyard, it just makes for a whole full experience for, you know, that.
Yeah. Courtyard is just fantastic. Like, by the way, if you've read the Courtyard comic, you owe it to yourself to go back and read the original short story.
Okay, I've never done
it. It is brilliant. Okay, like it is better than the comic.
Okay.
Like the comic does a fine job of adapting it, but it is still an adaptation. Like the original prose short story is brilliant. Like legitimately brilliant. The language, like he's kind of doing this H.P. Lovecraft homage language, but like much more refined. And then towards the end, if you know, the character starts speaking in Aklo, right? So the narration goes into Aklo, like the entire story goes into Aklo.
Oh, wow.
Like, unlike in the comic where you're seeing what's happening and then the narrator is narrating in Aklo, here the entire story becomes incomprehensible at the end.
Oh, wow. That's like,
it's beautifully done.
That does sound great. Awesome. I'm assuming at the scene in the courtyard, and all of a sudden just complete incoherence, like that.
It's the same thing where he's talking to the like his latest victim.
Yeah.
And you realize that the entire story is being narrated to his latest victim, which is also the case in the comic. But again, in the prose, it really recontextualizes the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Like it's a good thing. It's a good story. Yeah. More is a good writer.
Yes, he is, yeah.
Right?
I love Avatar. All their, you know, great writers on there have freedom to do whatever they please, which is a nice thing about the publishing company.
I don't know. Like I've heard they don't pay the artists. I don't know. Yeah. I can't.
Like
there's nothing for me to confirm.
Yeah.
So, let's move on.
It's all good. Yeah, yeah, we'll cut it off. We'll cut it off. Yeah. I'm just from a consumer, so we'll cut that off. I'm just like, I love these.
I mean, the some of the writing is fantastic. Like, especially what more like Crossed Plus 100 is fantastic as well.
Yeah.
I actually like, did you read Kieran Gillen's Crossed?
I haven't read it. Yeah, it's one that him and Spurrier's Crossed.
It's good. Yeah. It's really good. Like, there's just, I think, two issues. And it's really nice. It's like, I enjoyed it. And it's exactly the way you would imagine Kieran doing a cross story.
I also want to invest in God is Dead. I haven't read any of that yet, but just I think it's fascinating that it's like, pick.
Yeah. I only read the Alan Moore stories.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and now it's on like volume 35 or something. And I'm like, wow.
It's still going on.
Still going on. Like just cause they
really
releases, but I looked on Comixology, maybe it's not still going on today, but there's something like 30 volumes. I know because,
wow,
try to read this one.
That's like a weird thing, 50 to 180 issues. Finding
their books, because like I have like a blog that does releases, and they always talk about collected editions. Like just recently, they're like, it's a collected edition of the Moore and Spurrier one, and then I like look online, I can't find it anywhere, and I don't see it at comic shops. So like when they say it's being released, I'm like, where is it being released to? Is it just Chaz? You might know more about that. Where do they release those books to when Avatar releases? And then it just seems like it's in the nether.
Well, that's like a question a lot of people are asking them.
Yeah, he doesn't know.
Yeah, I'm at a loss for that one. Man, yeah, they've done quite a lot.
A lot of people have been chasing them for the Providence Compendium, including myself. So they're finally delivering. It's nice.
Oh, yeah, it's...
Imagine it's an Alan Moore late period masterpiece that was just uncollected, completely ecstatic
that now I can have it with my other books instead of just like on my iPad. Like I like digital books, but for me, like I'll say it all the time, it's not the same experience. Like I'm interested because I want to read all these characters' works that I love, but also like want that physical copy as soon as possible, just because, you know, I know those will be out quick. Like it won't be an Avatar situation where you wait, you know, almost 10 years. I think Providence came out in 2012, right? So we were waiting. Oh, 2015? Okay, so we've been waiting 4 years.
2015, it says. 2015 right. To 2017.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, like come like that. So the wait between Providence 10 and Providence 11 was some of the most ecstatic waiting that I've done for a comic. Because like I used to imagine what it would have been like to wait for Watchmen when it was releasing. And I got to experience some of that because Providence 10 is where Robert Black's story ends, right? And when Providence 10 ends, I was just like, wait, that's the story. How are they going to do two more issues?
I will say that...
Like, how do you get two more issues out of this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get 11.
Yeah, then you get 11, which is like a whole run through. Like, then after 11, 12 is quite predictable. Like, 12, you kind of know what's going to happen in 12.
I will say...
But between 10 and 11, I had zero clue what was going to happen.
Yeah, it was like, a long way.
How do you continue from this?
They kind of spoil it.
And that was just like, I think that was like a 7-month wait, I believe. Yeah. And I was just delightfully waiting. I was like, I have no idea.
In the back of the companion, it kind of spoils that.
History, I have no idea what's coming next.
And 12, like they're like, and I was like, but like reading this and then kind of just not knowing what's happening next, especially if you've read the previous work, is much more thrilling. Yeah. No. But if you read the back of the book.
Yeah, because there's no diary entry on after 10, I think. Right. So just waiting for 7 months after that, it's just
many times just brilliant. With the, I love any this. Book, even though the waits do suck.
Like finally,
like, but waiting is also great because you're anticipating it. Like, why the last man's last issue, which was a very long wait. Another great book, and then it was almost. I mean, I think Chaz, you might. It was almost. I'd have to look it up, but for me, it felt like almost 2 years.
Oh, was it? I didn't know that.
The break from. It was. It was definitely more than a year. There was the 49. And then at least a year to issue 50, maybe more, because he got involved writing on Lost. So when he was writing, have time to finish a story. It may have even been 2 years. I just remember that was one of the long.
Right.
Yeah. Like a lot more time to.
And that would explain why the last issue was so much better than the second last.
Yvonne, we're all waiting now also on Saga, which hopefully returns soon. Like he definitely has me.
I'm really polishing it.
Yeah, and they gave you a warning, like, why the last man?
But then hey, see, at least they ended like the first like, half and like they're coming.
Planetary
half
too.
Yeah.
Planetary's last issue also was a like Planetary's last
and for one issue, that's incredible.
Yeah. Even the last, I think the last few
that issues. That one I remember. But I think the last three issues were quite late for that one.
Breaks in between each issue. Yeah.
And I believe the last issue was also delayed by his hard disk crash.
Yeah.
That was
the great like, fire.
The reason why we didn't get fell after that.
New Universal, yeah.
Yeah.
And I blame New Universe on that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he just abandoned that after that. Yeah.
I don't think it was selling well either, which probably I would abandon it too.
I also think that it was probably a case of burnout. Like, I mean, he was working a lot. During that time. So I'm sure he burned out a little as well. He's like, fuck that, I'm not redoing that.
I wouldn't either.
There was something like that in the Doctor Who universe once where there was this very long anticipated novel called So Vile a Sin, and the guy like I think lost half the manuscript in a hard disk crash and just couldn't finish it, so he handed it over to somebody else and told them like I can't bear to rewrite all of this, so here's my plot, here's the half of the book that I did, can you please finish it?
Oh man, that's a good way to creatively problem solve that I mean that disappointment and the loss, like just
imagine like losing
all those
half
stories
a book,
just make me always like 150 or 180 pages of writing. Like always write on paper too. I hate writing on paper though, I'm so used to typing now, but also like hard disk crash, like it's gone. Nice. Yeah, that's what I was raised on typing.
Well, you can use typewriters like I do.
One of those. That's,
like,
keep it.
All right.
I back up my hard drive.
I actually lost that.
I regularly back up my hard drive.
I lost 21,000 words of a novel when I was like 23, 24. And that was heartbreaking. And after that, I've always written in Dropbox. Like all my files are in Dropbox, and I just edit them.
That's awesome. Yeah,
like Google that's Drive, what
keep everything back.
Never lost anything
like
after
LSI
that.
Too. Yeah, there's a cloud backup.
Isn't there like
a
cloud backup?
Yeah,
I think Windows has a cloud backup built in that you just have to activate. Pay some subscription for.
Yeah, I think Mac does as well, like iCloud Drive. But I just use Dropbox on everything. So I just, and I have a pro account. So I just, I have a writing folder in Dropbox and I just try to build it.
Smart.
I have just like an external hard drive that every once a month or whatever, I just copy everything over.
That makes more sense. Yeah. Yeah. For, I do that with my lettering. Like I don't letter out of Dropbox. That would be insane. I just back it up once in a while. Yeah. I have lost like 3 days of lettering once.
Ouch.
Because I forgot to do a time machine backup.
Get you, huh?
Yeah. But then I didn't re-letter everything. What I did was, so what happened was I upgraded my Mac to the next OS and the OS wasn't working. So I would have had to like restore from time machine 3 days ago. So before doing that, I just went into my hard drive. I copied all the folders that I figured I'd worked on in the last 3 days. And I copied those out. Then I did the time machine restore and then I restored those back. Yeah. That was clever.
Yeah. That's a good workaround.
You gotta do what you gotta do, huh?
Yes.
Modern problems require modern solutions.
Funny world we live in.
I probably have to cut out.
There we go.
This has been great again. I love having you on. Sometimes we just talk about all the stuff we love talking about. Talk about November. Kind of the same with Alex. All you guys, like, I don't know if you listen to me on Alex's episode. We were supposed to talk about his books and immediately just spiraled into conversations.
Oh, I loved the first one. I was a huge fan of that. I laughed throughout that episode. I loved that episode.
Yeah.
I haven't heard the recent one, if you did one.
We haven't done it yet. It's not till October.
You should get him back.
Yeah, we're getting him and Dan week after. Yeah,
I have like a monthly chat with him and it's just amazing. Like it's just fantastic.
It is amazing, yeah.
I think he's one of the smartest people working in comics, full stop, like just in the size of his brain. It's like he's just got a massive brain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, galaxy brain, yeah.
He's a great like guest because not only does he start the conversation, but everyone's included and like everything he says is very funny and it's great to like, it's a great guest, but he has so much things to say, and I love that he will be the first one to get off topic of his books.
Yeah.
The
advantage with me is that if the book sells more, I'm probably not getting any more money. So like we can just move off the topic of my books.
Yeah. We're having Dan on the 3rd and him on the 10th. We're doing both of them and doing a mini on them too.
Yeah, that's
together.
Fun.
Nervous because we haven't met Dan yet.
He's
I'm sure it'll be just as fun.
Yeah, he's a fantastic guy and like again like brain the size of a planet, so
yeah,
these guys are great.
I know people. Ram's story that him and Alex are the people he calls for like any comic book knowledge, like they know everything about DC and Marvel characters, which
absolutely nice. And I mean they it's interesting to me, like all four of them have very different intellects but they are all like incredibly intelligent people. And there's zero bullshit. Like I have sat in with conversations where they're ripping apart each other's writing and it's very sincere. It's very good faith. It's very helpful, but it's all there. Like, I mean, they will like you can't argue. Like, I mean, you better have your facts ready. Like it's they're going to give you a good reason why something doesn't work. It's all going to be backed up by like understanding of structure, understanding of, you know, how a story works. And all of those. So like, it's really like, I mean, every time I send us, like I once in a while send a story to Dan and Ram to read. And like, once I'm done editing it after that conversation, it's just so much upgraded. Like, it's just fantastic.
It's nice
to have people like that in your corner.
Definitely. I mean, that's the best kind of constructive criticism, especially when they know so much about storytelling. Like Alex taught me so much as we had him on. About all these, you know, techniques of storytelling, which I didn't even think of. I like writing, so it's great to get more knowledge from people that really understand structure.
Yeah, like I mean, if you're most of the structural stuff and stuff like you, I think he told you about like the Craig Mazin like 3-act structure dialogue, right? Like where he explains why 3-act structure works the way he does, and that kind of came out of a conversation with me and him, and if you've read all the standard storytelling books and if you're looking for something like a different point of view, let's say, like there's a book called The Art of Dramatic Writing by a guy called Lajos Egri. And it goes into like it deals with character, it deals with the journey to a degree, but largely it is about the primary question that any work is asking. Like, what is your premise? What is your thesis statement? And then how do you construct a scene that, like, it's kind of like, so basically the idea is that you are making a primary argument, and the point of your story is to prove that argument right. But each and every scene will be a counter argument, and then you, like, you basically take your argument, you take the counter argument, you make them fight, and at the end of the like scene, like, you have a synthesized version of your argument, and then by the end of the story, you either prove your argument right or you prove it wrong, right? So that's how a story kind of works. So it's his thesis. It's a very different thesis than like most writing books. And that's primarily why it was interesting to me. Like, it's just like, no, I don't think most writers think this way right now. So, and this is from the 1930s.
That's good. I just wrote it down.
Like, it's a very old writing.
Dang.
I definitely like reading writing books. And I also have like a weird obsession of trying to like break down like Waiting for Godot. I don't know if you've seen them play movies. Like,
I'm not entirely sure that's very helpful. Like, I know that people say that you should break down existing stories, but okay, I'll tell you a problem with structured writing. Like, I ran away from structure for a really long time, and I've recently come back to it. The reason I ran away was that I kind of agree with Stephen King when he says that a lot of structured stories are very anemic. Like, I would rather not name writers, but there are writers where I can tell that this is an incredibly plotted story because the characters are not doing anything that I feel has surprised the writer. Or like, you know, there's that spark of life that you want. So I feel like structure is purely one tool in your toolbox. It cannot be the primary story. Like, but again, then like structure is different things to different people, right? Like for Ram, for example, I think structure is very primary, but the way he looks at structure is not just 3-act structure. He looks at structure as like, what am I trying to do? And how is the scaffolding working for that? Right. So like kind of analyzing other people's stories is a very limited way of doing that. Because at some point of time, like the secret to writing is writing. Like you write a story, you finish it. The moment you finish a story, you will understand 150% like of what you understood before you finished the story. Because just the act of finishing the story lets you see what your thoughts are in action. Right. And unless you put these things into action over and over again, your knowledge is not going to be increased by just reading other people's stuff. So like, I would like generally recommend not to read too many, you know, writing books, but do more writing and like read those books when you feel like, oh, I need a little punch up. There's something missing in my thinking that I need to kind of add. Then you read these books. But till then, like the answer to the question of writing is to write. So that's very important.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. I always write more.
Seriously, you're going to learn more out of doing a terrible 4-issue miniseries than you are out of reading like 4. You just write that 4-issue miniseries and you throw it away. You don't publish it, but you'll have learned so much from finishing.
Nothing can replace experience.
Yeah, learning from experience and failures. I mean, you never succeed unless you fail also. You got to.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah.
You can only get good at something by sucking at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, I haven't had that many things published in the last 2 or 3 years, but that doesn't mean I haven't written many things. I have written a lot of failed stuff. Like, I just, every time I learned something and I threw it away. So like, okay, there you go. That's done. I'm going to move on to the next
thing. I like that.
I like that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that was November.
That was November.
That was November.
A wonderful, thrilling, engrossing crime. Well, one evening in a burning city.
One evening in real quick in Portland, right? Is that Portland?
I guess it's Portland.
It could be.
It's supposed to be Portland, I heard. Yeah, but that was thrilling. And, you know, Aditya, once again, thank you for coming on. Always the best conversation.
This was fun. Yeah, as usual.
Yeah, it's really enjoyable. Yeah, I love the conversation. We love the books too. This is,
yeah. So if you guys do ever do manga again and you do Pluto, like that's my next.
It's on my list.
Oh, you're Urasawa.
You can see Pluto like behind the plant there.
Nice.
Like all that.
Yeah. Instead, we should just do a Urasawa miniseries. We're going to put him in manga, but I could do. We could do Pluto, we could do 20th Century Boys, we could do...
You should get Dan to do 20th Century Boys. He's a huge fan.
I'll talk to him. I'm a huge fan. That's my favorite manga ever. I'll bring
I loved the first two-thirds of it. Like, I loved the first 16 volumes. After that, I don't really think the remaining 8 volumes were necessary.
Oh, really? I could see where it just kind of gets
pulled along and it doesn't really go anywhere after that. Like everything it had to communicate is done in the first 16 volumes.
We have a contract. We need to finish it out.
Yeah, I can see that. I feel like it was just very popular, which I'm guessing is why.
I'm guessing so. Like, you know, it was like a TV series. Like it was like How I Met Your Mother that got extended. Like it was supposed to be 5 seasons, but it got extended to 10 seasons or whatever. I have a feeling
that... There's a definite point where you can see that.
I will say like there is a twist. Like you will know that twist. At the end of, I think, volume 5. That is unlike anything I've read. Like, it is just incredible. Like, I was in awe of that. I couldn't, like, I opened the, like, next volume. I saw the first page. I closed it. I was like, I need to think about this.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Chaz and his Southern, the twists in that story are just,
Some of those, like, the first 8 volumes or so are magnificent. The next 8 volumes are good. The next 8 volumes,
looking
I don't think
like
needed to
the response to our manga season, I think we were talking about just kind of interlacing them throughout comics. Like, maybe we can just throw a Pluto or 20th Century Boy episode in with the mix somewhere along the line. Comics, but throw some mangas in there.
I think that might make sense. Because I think your audience is probably all... I think your audience is American comics people, right?
So. Primarily.
Yeah, when we were doing manga, our listener rate crashed. Like, it was fun for the first 3 episodes, but then after that...
I think that might be a better idea. But yeah, like, when you do Pluto, I'm in. And you should definitely ask Dan to do 20th Century Boys.
I will. That sounds like a blast. I just got, real quick, before we can finally get off, I just got a Humanoids collection called The Tipping Point. And Urasawa has a story in it that's like fully colored, like an American comic. So I'm interested.
Did he color it himself?
It's laid out like an American comic.
I think I've seen a couple of illustrations colored by him. They're very good.
I know. I don't know if he colored it or not. I haven't opened it yet, but I know that he has a story that's laid out like an American comic.
Right. Off
color. He's a kind of very smart guy. Like, have you seen Man Ben?
I know about it, the show. I've never seen it.
Incredible. I think it's my favorite. Yeah. Comic book related media from a different like media, like, so Manben is basically like Naoki Urasawa no Manben, and it's basically him interviewing other mangaka about their process, and like you have like a recording of like 2 to 3 days of the mangaka's process, and he goes from, I think there's Inio Asano is there, and like a bunch of like Junji Ito is there. So like there's a bunch of like really well-known mangaka, and you get to see their process. And I really want something like that to be there in American comics. And I actually, so I was talking about this with somebody random, and I said, Elsa Sharetia might be the right person to do this kind of show. And Elsa's husband tweeted at me and saying like, shh, we have plans.
Wow. Oh, wow.
So like that might be happening, awesome. I guess.
And we can
do that. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I think so. That was on Twitter, like in public.
Just want to make sure.
Yeah. This is not like a private conversation. It might not happen. Like, I don't know, but like, I would love it. And they're the perfect people to make it because they have just great production values, and like, they know how to interview other people. So like, it's great. Otherwise, I was basically saying like, if nobody wants to do this, just somebody make the show. I will host it. Like, I'm very happy to interview people about their process. But I think Elsa would be even better.
Start to wrap it up.
Yeah.
It's been like...
Yeah.
Aditya, once again, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
You want to let people know on Twitter or any social media?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at Aditya B. Instagram at Aditya Bidikar, and my website is at adityab.net. And on my website, you can sign up for my newsletter. But if you directly want to do that, that is buttondown.email/AdityaB.
Awesome.
So, yeah,
right, that's on. It.
And you all can find the show at Outside The on Twitter. You can find me at PoetError33. And where can they find you guys, Chaz and Jack?
You can find me on Twitter as well, at Chaz Simons.
And you can find me on Twitter at Sin_aesthetics with an X, or you can find my tunes anywhere at Sinesthetic.
And once again, we want to thank you so much, Aditya. Always a pleasure. And yeah, also, everyone, make sure to check out Jack's first album, which is out on most available platforms.
Nice.
Feral Kid, it's out there. Make sure you get it. I know he's releasing a lot of new stuff
that's
coming out. And Chaz,
I was going to say, Aditya, did you want to take this one? You want to give us that fun closing line? You want to say
thanks for listening?
Yeah.
No.
I like that. And then turn the page and wash your hands. Outside the Pages.